For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'll be talking about something that keeps coming up for me in my own practice and understanding, and it's rather selfish because by preparing a talk, I'm hoping to gain a little bit of clarity, but even more so by hearing what you have to say about it. I'm not an expert or a, you know, I can't speak with authority or even a whole lot of certainty about what Zen teaches or what Buddhism teaches about this or that, but I can speak about my own experience in relation to some things that I've read and that I've heard, but I will appreciate any course correction that you might want to offer me tonight afterwards as we discuss. I appreciate that. And I'll be sharing three passages, reading three passages from some of my favorite 20th century writers. They're a little longer than the usual kinds of quotes we use here, but I trust their words more than my own on this subject, so I'm going to quote them a little bit at length. And I'm going to be speaking about something that happens in Zazen, something that happens between our individual conscious self and what Shunryu Suzuki calls big mind, or sometimes called universal self, or Buddha nature, or many other names, and I'll get to that in a minute. And something happens when we bring our difficulty, our existential dis-ease, if it's there, our boredom, whatever's going on, into Zazen, and it meets something more that is not limited by those things. That something more is not limited by whatever we're feeling or going through or thinking or able to accomplish in our time of sitting. And something happens. Something happens in that engagement, and it's marked often by equanimity and perspective, guidance. There's a lot of different descriptors you could use for that. So what is this something more, and what is it doing? Here's the first of these quotes from Shunryu Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I discovered that it is necessary, absolutely necessary, to believe in nothing. You could also read that as no thing. That is, we have to believe in something which has no form, but which is always prepared for taking some particular form. This is called Buddha nature or Buddha himself. This is not just theory. This is not just the teaching of Buddhism. This is the absolute necessary understanding of our life. The big mind in which we must have confidence is not something which you can experience objectively. It is something which is always with you, always on your side. The mind which is always on your side is not just your mind. It is universal mind, always the same, not different from another's mind. It is Zen mind. It is big, big mind. It is whatever you see. Although you do not know your own mind, it is there. At the very moment you see something, it is there. So when Shunryu Suzuki talks about it's important to believe in this, or to have confidence in this, I think it's pretty obvious that he's not talking about believing that something like that exists in a theoretical way or a, you know, sort of philosophical belief of some kind, you know, believing a principle of some sort of Buddhism. He's talking about the kind of confidence or belief that is placing our trust in it, counting on it, which is a kind of faith. Elsewhere in Zen and in Chan sources, there are many names for this, and it's always described as a kind of quality of being. It's not never a thing. It's not a being. It's not a spirit. It's not some kind of essence at the core of everything. It's more like a descriptor of the basic of reality. Single universal energy, formless field of benefaction, bright empty field, space containing all, true nature, pure being, the source, ultimate reality, Buddha nature, and there's hundreds more. And I love that there are lots and lots of names because it some of the names undermine others and they bring out different qualities and you can't pin it down. But they're all sort of poetic expression rather than definitions. And they're all pointing to something that is infinitely more than the individual or conscious self. So this big mind, this Buddha nature, however, is not separate from the individual self. It's not like here I am and I'm having this encounter with this big mind over here somehow. And this is the second of these quotes I wanted to use tonight is from Kosho Uchiyama's Opening the Hand of Thought, a wonderful, wonderful book. The power of life, and that's his descriptor for it in this passage, the power of life that functions inside each individual goes beyond the thoughts of the small I, and in this sense is all-pervading. In this sense, all existence, all living beings are living out the power of one great all-pervading life. During Zazen, we completely let go of the self-consciousness of an individual self and wake up to all-inclusive self that is the reality of life. Self that is simultaneously personal and universal. To think that universal self is apart from personal self is just a limited comparison in the brain, just a variant of self versus other. And so in holding whatever you encounter, you simply hold the self. We live by experiencing all things. All things exist as my own life. The reality of all things and the reality of my life are one and the same. When we practice with whatever we encounter as our lives, we finally encounter our true selves. So it's easy to talk about unity this way, but the strange thing is, the mysterious thing, is that even though there is no separation, there is some kind of distinction, and even more so, there's some kind of internal interaction that goes on, at least in my experience, between the small I and the universal self. It's not different beings or different essences or anything. It's simply some kind of internal interaction that's taking place. And here, perhaps, there is something that the faith traditions and certainly 12-step recovery programs can offer that is part of this Buddhist language that I'm using here. And that is the recognition in this internal interaction between the small self and the big mind that we can let go of our conscious ability to understand, to control, to change, to be sober in the case of someone who's an addict, to be more spiritual, whatever. We can stop this relentless self-effort and open the hand of thought in Zazen, drop off body and mind, a kind of surrender. And then we can put our trust in, we can put our confidence in something more that exists without form but does exist, that is not under our control or understanding, but is on our side, as Shunryu Suzuki said. And what happens is that a universal energy rises up, and it has its own direction. It has a particular quality to it. It is not just whatever. It comes from and it aims towards Buddha nature. And that's why I think Zen teachers can verify its appearance. They recognize it. It is always the same. And then we are able to be and to do what we couldn't be or do on our own. This is what theistic religions call grace. And it's what people in recovery point to when they say that now with this power I can do what I couldn't do before for years of trying. So to use another theistic word by Katagiri Roshi, I was sort of surprised to come across this passage because it's not too often you hear the P word, the prayer word. And this is the third of these passages that I said I'd be using. There is nothing to ask for help from in this world, but there is something we can appeal to beyond the human world, even though we don't know exactly what it is. To do that, we pray for our lives, for others' lives. We pray to the vastness of space and existence. The altar in a church and the altar in the Buddhist temple are a little higher than we are, so we always look up when we pray. And when you pray, you kneel down to the floor, you become lower. In other words, you become humble. Intellectually, we don't understand it, but spiritually, everyone knows. This is the meaning of appeal. Then the response comes from the whole universe, from space. It comes. If we feel the spirit of the universe completely and appeal for help or appeal that we may come alive in our everyday life, very naturally we can be one with the universe. This is response. In other words, if we reach out our hands to the universe sticks out its hand to us. Then the path of your life and the path of the universe cross each other, become one, interconnected. Well, my experience of this is, happens at times, and at times in Zazen, certainly not all the time. But often what I call me seems to become porous. It's like the metaphor image of a home that is this me, with all of the windows and doors open. Where the walls themselves become kind of transparent, so that wind and light and sounds and animals and other people, my thoughts, my concerns, other people's thoughts and concerns, come in and out. And there is a home that is me, but its boundaries are vague. As one of these quotes said, the reality of all things and the reality of myself are one and the same. I'm still Brian, but I'm also the infinite life energy manifesting as all things at once. Kodo Sawaki has this wonderful phrase, the self, selfing the self, where Buddha becomes Buddha and Zazen sits Zazen. Now, the effect of this kind of internal interaction that's happening between different aspects of self, perhaps, is clarity and openness. It's a still and stable place, a reliable place of uprightness, and we all know what that's like. And out of that place, who we are and what to do and how to respond becomes obvious and natural, without confusion or personal baggage. There is a graceful quality, an immediacy, a lack of separation. But this whole thing that I'm talking about is not just for our own personal edification, for our, feeling of oneness with the universe. It's also what makes possible empathy and response to the needs and the suffering of others. And I think by cultivating this, this quality, we can be of more service in the world, both in very small ways, but also in large ways, because I think over time we're more inclined to do a kind of work with our lives that is self-sacrificing in some extent, or really trying to be of service to the world around us, because we know it's all our life, and we are its life. This evening, a group of you met, and you talked about participating in a rally coming up that's responding to the very real situation of very real people who are suffering on the borderlands of our nation and coming up to that from the south. And your response there is one of empathy, and that comes from this place of, I think, having been opened up, perhaps, and having experienced some kind of grace that changes you. And then you turn and offer that same grace to other people. It's the same grace. Because we experience the universe sticking out its hand to us, we stick out our hand to others naturally. As we say in the meal verses, you know, which you might call grace before dinner, may we with all beings realize the emptiness that is the lack of separation of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. So I'd love to hear your responses, your experience of what I'm trying to talk about, or your course corrections, please.
Wholehearted practice.
I'll just let that question sit in the air here.
Listening to your talk, Brian, reminded me of something that this occurred to me, and that is to say it's not a thought process. I don't have it all the time. It comes and goes. But there are times, most of the time it's gone. But there's times when I just feel it's experiential. And I had an experience at the class when we were talking about something. I realized I thought I knew what dependent coalizing meant. Thought I had a dot goal. And then something happened in class, and all of a sudden I realized, no. And also, what came to me is all one reality. And it was something that I felt in my bones, in my marrow, rather than something up here in my mind. I think that's what you were touching on a little bit. It's the big mind. It's not something that's a concept you keep up here. It's something that's more expansive. Ourselves come out. We allow ourselves to expand and come out rather than just being in thought. So this experience that I've had recently just absolutely blows me away. I think that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, and it has its own energy and its own direction, its own life. Buddha.
I mean, the coming and going. It's going to sound like a naive question, but why? What? It seems like the oneness is so powerful that, but still we only have these glimpses of it or the gaps. Is it delusion that is more powerful than that oneness? I struggle with that. I don't know that we should desire that should be a permanent thing, right? But it's almost like tragic how ephemeral that
yeah.
is. You
know? I guess I wouldn't say that it's more powerful. Delusion is more powerful, but the sense of being separate and substantial of not being empty is powerful, and it's. Relentless in its attempt to control and to build a self and a life, and that's why Zazen but Zazen is powerful, and it's that's why I keep returning to it, because there's this opportunity to, you know, open all those windows and doors of that house. And let something else in that I'm not in control of, that is ultimately the only real and powerful thing.
It's liberation, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for your talk, Ryan. So many beautiful things in it. I'm a little baffled by your request for a course correction. You seem so clear about it.
Just hedging my bets, you know. Well, I've told some of you this in conversation. I really, as much as I read and sit and attend retreats and listen to talks and, you know, I'm a beginner. And I know you're supposed to always be a beginner, and I know everybody would say, yeah, well, so am I. But, I mean, I really am. I don't feel that I can speak with authority about and say, well, this is Zen, this is Buddhism. So it helps me at least to say, you know, I may be getting this wrong, but at least it's my response to a lot of things that I've been reading and hearing in this tradition.
Allowing that, you know, like I know why I had said it, the cell-like permeable cell membranes. You know, like cells have to have this membrane that has integrity, but like they also are constantly in communication on a cellular level with the world. And there's a neutrality to that, you know, like if something's gonna like kill you, the cell's trying to like say, you know, we can't come in right now. It's other door. You know, and so there's this kind of unknowable stuff going on all the time from the most basic level. And I was thinking about Zazen as being this grateful attitude, posture of that, a posture of grace and dignity.
Yeah, it's almost training the mind to behave in the way that nature naturally behaves, that permeability that you talk about, and the oneness of all ecosystems, and you know, even at the cellular level, there's this interplay going on all the time with this one life energy, and where our brains just don't want to do that, and it's sort of, we're sort of training the mind to be natural, which sounds like a contradiction.
Training the body, yeah.
It's
an interesting, that's where I think this opening and end of thought is such a beautiful image and so like deep and resonant, like the bell. Because it's a physical, you know, the mudra is a physical bell tips, so you can put a little piece of paper in there.
But, you know, it's real important for me to always remember that this is not some idealized state I'm talking about, that I should always be this way, because I'm not. I mean, we're all human, and I can be a jerk sometimes, and I'm not this graceful, open person that's, you know, seeing myself as one with you and all that. I mean, but it's something that's accessible. It is accessible. And I count on that.
Neil saw yesterday, you know, like we like these images of the whole world, the Zenki, the total dynamic functioning, and all these words as like these beautiful images. But grace is a grace that's given to everything, even the jerk.
Right.
You know, or the part of myself that is grasping.
Right. The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. Yeah it's just falling.
No, I do. I don't know if this is a course correction, but you just said you're not always like that.
Yeah.
But from one point of view, of course, you are exactly always like that. And the problem is that we almost make an effort not to be by trying to, like, you know, kind of freaking out that these walls seem a little bit too permeable and transparent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, they are, but it You know, right. So we kind of have trouble accepting that for whatever reasons, and then that's when we're not. You know, that's when we think we're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of that idea that, one way to talk about it in the text is, you're always already enlightened, you're just confused about it, you know, because
mm-hmm.
of so much.
Yeah, it's a really good image because it doesn't it doesn't suggest that we're somehow or another building up this quality. I mean, it's just there, and our work is to let the covering fall off and reveal what's already there. What term is that?
Nivaras. It's afflictive emotions, essentially, hindrances. But the term comes from varnish, a cover. Just like sincere is without wax, without that covering, protective cover. Mm-hmm. Well, protective, right? That's the freak out. Like, I'm going to protect myself. That's what I was thinking of referring to, right?
Yeah. And that it's like we're humans, and we are.
Yeah, Chris.
Okay. What if we end with